Greetings, I'm Sue, and today is June 24th, 2026, and this is Reuters. First article, Trump's power takes center stage in U.S. Supreme Court's home stretch. The U.S. Supreme Court's current term is rapidly approaching a final climactic finale in which some of its biggest cases yet to be decided will test Donald Trump's aggressive efforts to expand presidential authority. The court issued 5 rulings on Tuesday, with more expected on Thursday. Its annual terms run from early October to around the end of June, sometimes spilling into July. The court has not announced when it will wrap up its term and begin a summer recess. The court often waits until the end of its term to issue its most consequential rulings. This year is unusual for the number of major cases lingering that involve the critical issue of presidential power, and Trump's particularly bold use of it. The cases involve his efforts to limit birthright citizenship, fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, oust Democratic members of independent agencies, and terminate a humanitarian legal status protecting hundreds of thousands of Syrian and Haitian immigrants from deportation. It's totally normal for the most important cases of the term to come out in the last few days. What is unusual is that there are so many blockbuster cases, said University of Michigan constitutional law professor Sam Ehrman, an expert on the Supreme Court. Trump has pushed to expand presidential powers during his second term in office in domestic affairs and foreign policy, drawing hundreds of legal challenges on numerous fronts. The Supreme Court, whose 6-3 conservative majority includes 3 justices Trump appointed during his first term, has shown it is receptive, backing many of his emergency requests to implement policies impeded by lower courts while litigation over their legality continues. Over the years, the court's conservative majority has increasingly embraced a legal theory called the unitary executive that places power over the U.S. government's executive branch solely in the hands of the president. But the embrace may have its limits. Of the major Trump cases on which the justices heard arguments, many court watchers have predicted that Trump has a better chance of vindicating his firings of independent Federal Commission members than his actions on birthright citizenship or Cook. They have a view of a strong executive, but it's not an unlimited executive, Ehrman said of the conservative justices. So when he is essentially advancing their project, he's pretty likely to win. The court is unlikely to be sympathetic that Trump, through an executive order, can restrict birthright citizenship, Ehrman said. The Republican president's order, a politically charged part of his hardline immigration approach, would upend a long-standing interpretation of the Constitution's 14th Amendment provision recognizing the citizenship of people born in the United States. The court already delivered a major rebuke of Trump's audacious wielding of power, striking down in February sweeping global tariffs that he had imposed under a law meant for national emergencies. That ruling prompted Trump to lash out at the court in general and disparage the justices who ruled against him. Other major cases that do not directly involve Trump, including those that will impact elections, transgender rights, and state firearm laws, also remain to be decided. The court is weighing a challenge by Republicans in Mississippi to a state law that allows a 5-day grace period for mail-in ballots received after Election Day to be counted, a case that could lead to stricter voting rules around the country. In a case involving Vice President J.D. Vance, the court is also set to rule on a Republican-led bid to strike down on free speech grounds federal limits on spending by political parties in coordination with candidates. The court's conservative majority in April gutted a pillar of the Voting Rights Act, a landmark 1965 civil rights law that aimed to prevent racial discrimination in voting. That ruling prompted a frenzied round of redistricting across the South to eliminate U.S. House of Representatives districts where black voters make up a majority or near majority, as Republican-led states scramble to take advantage of the decision. The Republicans are seeking to retain control of Congress in the November midterm elections. Black voters tend to support Democratic candidates. The court is also weighing, in cases from West Virginia and Idaho, whether to uphold state laws banning transgender athletes from female sports teams amid escalating efforts nationwide to restrict the rights of transgender people. On gun rights, the court is set to deliver its judgment on a challenge, backed by Trump administration, to a Hawaii law that restricts the carrying of handguns on private property open to the public, like most businesses, without the owner's permission. The court last week unanimously rejected a position taken by Trump's administration that had threatened the gun rights under the Constitution's Second Amendment of millions of Americans who use marijuana and own firearms. Next article. Millions lose food stamps under Trump cuts. Arizona is hardest hit. When Angela Garcia tried to renew her food stamps this spring, she said she thought she knew the drill. The single mother of three in Tucson filled out the application. She repeatedly called Arizona's Department of Economic Security, the state agency administering the federal aid, often staying on hold until the line dropped. She visited a thinly staffed DES office and waited hours for a caseworker. By the time Garcia was reapproved in June, she'd missed 2 months of benefits while her family got by on food pantry donations and cheap staples like beans, rice, and tortillas. "There's hoops to jump through, always," said Garcia, who has used food stamps in the state for 3 years. But now the government is adding more hoops. More than 4.7 million people nationwide have lost their Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, also known as food stamps, since President Donald Trump's signature tax and spending law took effect last July, according to data through March from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, about 11% of participants. Nowhere have the changes to America's second largest social safety net program taken hold as rapidly as in Arizona, where the number of SNAP recipients has fallen by about half, the steepest drop in the country. That means lost benefits for more than 457,000 Arizonans, including nearly 196,000 children, according to DCF data, as of the end of May. The law reduces SNAP funding by about $187 billion, or about 17%, over the next 10 years, in part by expanding work requirements and barring some immigrants from receiving benefits. It also imposes penalties on states that fail to meet certain performance standards beginning in October next year, and it shifts more administrative costs onto states. Among the reasons enrollment has fallen so steeply in Arizona is that the state has moved to implement the federal changes more quickly than other states, according to two SNAP experts and the DES spokesperson, Brett Bezio. Arizona has no choice but to meet these requirements, Liliana Soto, press secretary for Democratic Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs, said in an email. If we don't comply, we will be fined hundreds of millions of dollars and more vulnerable Arizonans will lose their food assistance. White House spokesperson Anna Kelly said that the SNAP overhaul prioritizes American citizens and implements reasonable cost-sharing measures with states to crack down on waste, fraud, and abuse without offering examples. The USDA's Food and Nutrition Administration, which administers SNAP, attributed the decline in enrollment in part to the work requirement changes. The SNAP cuts have driven a record number of people to food banks in Arizona, according to the Arizona Food Bank Network, a statewide organization that works with local pantries. About 843,000 Arizonans sought support from a food pantry in April, about an 8% increase over 779,000 in April of 2025, and surpassing the number of people receiving SNAP, according to an AFBN data. Food bank users fell in May to about 790,000, the data shows. Even so, food pantries are scrambling to fill a massive gap, said Terry Shoemaker, executive vice president of the AFBN. DES and the USDA did not comment on the increase in food bank use. Miriam Flores, a mother of seven in Phoenix, said in a May interview that she was unable to renew her access to SNAP and lost $1,100 a month and benefits in January. She said she spent hours on hold with Arizona's DES, only for calls to drop. At the time of her interview, she said she visits the St. Vincent's de Paul pantry in Phoenix nearly every day so she can feed her children. There are nights of crying, nights of not sleeping, when I lose sleep at 2 a.m. doing the math, deciding what to pay for and what to put off, she said. Reuters could not determine whether Flores has resumed her efforts to get benefits or whether she's currently eligible. Katie Berg, a senior policy analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, said that the longer wait times are partly the result of stricter processes for vetting applicants, introduced by Arizona's state agency to meet the new performance standards and avoid financial penalties. They can't get through on the overloaded phone line, or they're being asked for more and more paperwork that they can't provide, or they do provide it, but the state doesn't have the capacity to process it, she said. Those standards grew out of the state's SNAP error rate, a measure of overpayments and underpayments of food stamp benefits. Arizona's error rate in 2024 was 8.84%, below the national average of 10.9%, but still above the 6% threshold that, under the new law, would require states to cover up to 15% of the cost of SNAP benefits. Historically, the federal government has paid the full cost of benefits. That could cost Arizona about $201.5 million next year, according to the DES 2027 budget request. To avoid the threat of significant financial penalties, DES has tightened its application process by requiring documentation like pay stubs or leases, Bezio said. Cindy Bernardo, a program manager at the St. Vincent de Paul Pantry, said many of the organization's clients have faced delays or lost their SNAP benefits as the state enacts the federal changes. So many of them have lost their benefits, she said, and they have reapplied, and most of them can't even get an answer to their questions. The federal law also expanded work requirements to areas that previously had waivers because of high unemployment or insufficient jobs. 14 of Arizona's 15 counties are now subject to work requirements, compared to just one last year, said Joseph Palomino, director of the Arizona Center for Economic Progress. Those changes, as well as the new demands for documentation, are making it harder for people to get timely access to benefits, he said, and they're falling through the cracks. Bezio said the agency is hiring more staff and contracting with a third-party call center to improve wait times. Other states are recording steep drops in SNAP enrollment, 17.4% in Louisiana, 11.6% in Wyoming, and 13.7% in Virginia, USDA data show. The USDA's FNA said states are responsible for accurately implementing the federal changes and that it has issued guidance to help them meet new requirements. The Louisiana Department of Health did not respond to a request for comment. The Wyoming Department of Family Services said a large portion of the state's decline was due to the federal changes. In Virginia, SNAP enrollment fell 12% in the year ending in March, according to the Department of Social Services. The primary impact of this law on the Commonwealth is that now more families are going hungry when nobody should have to go hungry, said spokesperson Michael Pulley. Next article, Trump sent to mark nation's 250th birthday with campaign-style rally. President Donald Trump opens a 16-day celebration of the United States' 250th anniversary with a political rally on Wednesday, the start of festivities shaped by controversy over his polarizing approach to governing and efforts to remake Washington. Eager to pivot from a divisive war in Iran, Trump plans to use the event on the National Mall to tout a country he often takes credit for restoring to greatness ahead of the Independence Day milestone on July 4th. The kickoff underscores how Trump has blurred the line between official commemoration and campaign-style politics, repackaging a public fair in the heart of the nation's capital around the rally format that has defined his presidency. The anniversary events have been marked by months of friction, including unconventional programming, the withdrawal of several musical acts, and Trump's renovation of the Lincoln Memorial reflecting pool near the site of the celebrations. The festival initially was set to feature a broad lineup of performers, including Poison frontman Bret Michaels, Young MC, and the Commodores, but those acts and others withdrew amid concerns about joining a potentially partisan event. The revised program now includes musical performances by Lee Greenwood and Christopher Maccio, two artists favored by Trump and military bands. The event comes at a difficult political moment for Trump. The nearly four-month-old Iran war has pushed consumer prices to a three-year high and unnerved many voters, and the White House is working to counter perceptions that the term-limited Republican is becoming a lame-duck president. just 1 in 4 Americans believes the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran was worth its costs, a Reuters Ipsos poll found, and only 34% approve of Trump's overall performance in office 17 months into his second term. Trump has taken a personal interest in the celebrations, installing statues and other features around Washington and ordering a $16 million repair of the reflecting pool. On Tuesday, he said 6 people had been arrested for damaging the pool. Trump has also hosted mixed martial arts fights on the South Lawn of the White House last week, a spectacle that drew millions of television viewers, but most Americans found distasteful. Previous U.S. presidents also faced challenges that clouded anniversary celebrations, including a financial panic during John Quincy Adams's presidency in 1826 and anger in 1976 over inflation, unemployment, the fall of Saigon, and a decision to pardon former President Richard Nixon. Many of those presidents, nonetheless, used the occasion to emphasize unifying themes. Gerald Ford's top political advisor ordered speechwriters to avoid any partisan insinuations as they prepared for the 200th anniversary. Ulysses Grant, marking the 100th anniversary in 1876, criticized errors of judgment by Southern rebels during the Civil War, but also held out an olive branch by calling them courageous in their convictions. Trump has often taken a different approach, turning remarks before service members, college graduates, and sports teams into sharply political speeches, including taking swipes at his Democratic predecessors. Next article. Tucker Carlson's ALP nicotine pouches to launch in Europe, CEO says. U.S. nicotine pouch brand ALP, which is co-owned by U.S. conservative talk show host Tucker Carlson, will launch sales in 11 European markets from July, its CEO Lorenzo DiPlano said. ALP, co-owned by Carlson and Turning Points Brands, is the 4th or 5th largest nicotine pouch label in the United States, DiPlano told Reuters in an interview last week. Nicotine pouches are the fastest-growing tobacco product and increasingly drive growth at companies like Philip Morris International and British American Tobacco, whose products Zyn and Velo dominate the U.S. market. While ALP only has a U.S. market share of around 2%, it is growing fast, DiPlano said, adding that it is now preparing to compete in international markets with the aim of becoming the number 2 brand in the European Union by 2030. We want ALP to be everywhere, he said. ALP's connection with Carlson, an influential and outspoken right-wing voice in the U.S. who is popular with President Donald Trump's voting base, has helped the brand gain a foothold in the U.S. nicotine pouch market, the biggest globally. Competition is heating up in Europe, too, where Zyn is expanding as companies battle to capture a regional market that Grandview Research forecasts will reach over $6 billion in annual sales by 2031, up from almost $1.7 billion in 2024. ALP will launch online sales in Britain, Ireland, Greece, Switzerland, and Romania in July, followed by the Czech Republic, Poland, Portugal, and Spain in August and September, and Sweden and Denmark later this year. It will take longer for it to launch in stores, with Britain slated for 2027. It has signed up a manufacturer in Lithuania to produce 20 million units in 2026 and 50 million in 2027, and is in the process of securing deals with more suppliers, DiPlano said. In May, ALP signed a partnership with former UFC world champion Conor McGregor, which will see them collaborate on a marketing campaign to support ALP's international expansion. Next article. U.S. banks look for new bill of health from Fed stress tests. Financial markets will gain a fresh glimpse into the overall health of the largest U.S. banks on Wednesday when the Federal Reserve releases the results of its latest stress test. The results will reflect the health of 32 banks, including J.P. Morgan and Bank of America, but will likely be less dramatic than in prior years. The Fed said in February it would not use this year's results to update each firm's stress capital buffer, an added layer of capital large firms must hold that fluctuates based on how they will perform well on the test. With those buffers now holding steady, firms already have the information they need to make capital plans, including any potential stock buybacks or dividend changes. Raymond James analysts said in a note ahead of the results that they expect most banks to announce moderate dividend and stock buyback plans following the tests, noting that bank executives may opt for a more cautious approach given broader uncertainties. Despite the accommodative regulatory backdrop, we believe some management teams could be somewhat conservative given the aforementioned geopolitical macro uncertainty and inflationary pressures, they wrote. Rather, analysts say banks will likely wait to adjust plans until regulators have finished implementing several new capital rules favored by the industry, most notably the Basel proposal on risk-based capital under consideration. Those changes could unlock billions of dollars in additional capital for banks to return to investors or deploy within their business. The industry is in good shape with capital, as all the names have excess capital relative to the implied pro forma target capital ratios and requirements, as the industry continues to be in a position to take advantage of deregulatory momentum, wrote KBW analysts in a note previewing the stress tests. The central bank is reworking its stress testing process in response to years of criticism from the banking industry that the exams are opaque and subjective. Given that the central bank is still soliciting feedback on its plans to make the test more transparent, Fed officials opted to keep capital levels steady based on last year's exam. Next article, in sports, AJ to DC, Wizards pick BYU's Dibansa, number one overall in the NBA draft. As the clock ticked down to the announcement of the NBA's draft's first pick on Tuesday night, A.J. Dibansa's phone was in his father's possession. There was no tip-off call coming to prepare him for the news. He was just waiting for NBA Commissioner Adam Silver's voice to inform him whether the Washington Wizards were selecting him with the top choice. "When they said the pick was in, I was hoping it was me," Dibansa said on ESPN's broadcast. The news was what Dibansa envisioned, as Washington indeed selected the BYU forward with the number one overall pick ahead of Kansas guard Darren Peterson, who went second overall to the Utah Jazz during the festivities in New York. The 6'9" Dibansa led the nation in scoring at 25.5 points per game in his one college campaign and should be ready to make an immediate impact. "This means a lot," Dibansa said, going first in the draft. "It's a stepping stone. Obviously, I have a lot more work to do." This is the third time Washington has held the number one overall pick. The Wizards selected Kwame Brown in 2001 and John Wall in 2010. Dibansa is the first BYU player to go first overall. He made it clear he wants to be a difference maker for a Washington franchise that has victory totals of 17, 18, and 15 the past three seasons and missed the playoffs for five consecutive campaigns. "They are getting a super versatile player," Dibansa said of himself. "I'm willing to play multiple positions and guard multiple positions and do whatever it takes to win." The Jazz are a team stacked with front court players, so adding Peterson bolsters the backcourt. Peterson said his father repeatedly told him he would someday be a top NBA draft choice. "Honestly, I didn't, but my pops always knew," Peterson said. "Once I got older, I started to believe it well. All the work paid off." Peterson averaged 20.2 points last season, but missed 11 of the Jayhawks' 35 games and left early in others due to apparent injuries, including cramping. Dibansa and Peterson began a run of eight straight freshmen to start the draft. Duke forward Cameron Boozer went number three overall to the Memphis Grizzlies. He averaged 22.5 points and 10.2 rebounds last season for the Blue Devils. "As it happens, just joy," Boozer said. "This is my whole life in a couple seconds. It's amazing for sure." Boozer's dad, Carlos, was a former star for Utah and now works in the team's front office. The focus of his duties for the Jazz is evaluating NBA draft prospects. The Chicago Bulls chose forward Caleb Wilson of North Carolina fourth. Wilson averaged 19.8 points and 9.4 rebounds in his lone college season. "That kid got here by hard work, believing in himself, and having a great support system," Wilson said of going number four. The next four picks were guards, beginning with Los Angeles Clippers grabbing Keaton Wagler of Illinois. Wagler averaged 17.9 points, 5.1 rebounds, and 4.2 assists as a star freshman after being gratefully undervalued as a high school prospect. "I think it's just all the hard work I put in, Wagler said. I didn't worry about what anybody said and just stayed true to myself. The Brooklyn Nets tabbed Michael Brown Jr. of Louisville at number 6. Brown averaged 18.2 points and 4.7 assists, but played just 21 games due to injuries and shot 34.4% from the three-point range. Arkansas point guard Darius Acuff Jr. went 7th overall to the Sacramento Kings. He averaged 23.5 points and 6.4 assists and joined LSU legend Pete Maravich, and he was there in 1969 to 1970, as the only players to lead the Southeastern Conference in both scoring and assists in the same season. The Atlanta Hawks took Houston point guard Kingston Flemings at number 8. He averaged 16.1 points and 5.2 assists. The Dallas Mavericks formally announced the hiring of Dusty May as head coach Tuesday, and then selected forward Morey Johnson Jr. and one of the key players on May's championship team at Michigan. Johnson averaged 13.1 points and 7.3 rebounds. It's his second day, Johnson said of the freshman first non-freshman pick. He said that of May. I think it had a little bit to do with it, but not too much. It's insane. We won together this past season. Looking forward to him winning when I get there. And the Milwaukee Bucks reportedly traded two-time MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo to the Miami Heat for 4 players and 3 first-round draft picks, including this year's 13th overall pick, giving them 2 selections in a 4-pick span. And the Bucks tabbed Arizona's guard, Braden Burries, at number 10 with its own pick. Burries averaged 16.1 points and 4.9 rebounds. 2 other Michigan stalwarts went at number 11 and number 12. Forward Jaxel Lindborg went to the Warriors, followed by center Ade Mara to the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Memphis Grizzlies made 2 trades in the middle of the round to move back 5 spots and secure 5 future second-round draft picks. The Oklahoma City Thunder moved up 1 spot by enticing Memphis with 2 second-round picks in the deal, and the Thunder ended up with Iowa point guard Bennett Stirts at number 16. The Grizzlies then traded the number 17 pick to the Pistons for the number 21 spot and acquired 3 second-round selections. Detroit drafted Stanford guard Ibuka Okori with that pick. At number 21, Memphis took the top international prospect, forward Kareem Lopez of Mexico. Lopez has played professionally for the New Zealand Breakers. Among late-round picks, Alabama guard LeBron Fillon Jr. went to the Philadelphia 76ers at number 22. Iowa State forward Joshua Jefferson went 28th to the Minnesota Timberwolves. UConn forward Alex Caravan was chosen 29th by the Cleveland Cavaliers. Arizona forward Koa Peet was the 30th and final pick of the round. The second round is Wednesday night. Next article. More heat records expected as deadly Omega heat wave grips Europe. Out of Paris, London, and Rome, Western Europe was in the grip of a deadly record-setting heat wave on Wednesday that has killed dozens of people, closed schools, slowed trains, knocked out electricity, and forced farmers to harvest grain at night. In France, which on Tuesday recorded its hottest day since records began nearly 80 years ago, authorities sought to restore electricity to thousands of homes hit by power cuts in the northwestern region of Brittany. The recorded temperature peaked at 44.3 degrees Celsius, that's 111.7 degrees Fahrenheit, in the southwestern town of Pissos. Italy's health ministry issued its highest alert for 16 cities from Florence and Milan to Rome, Turin, and Verona. In Britain, on course for its hottest June day ever, the Met Office Weather Service issued only the second extreme heat weather warning in history. Hundreds of schools stayed shut or closed early, as high temperatures could place even healthy people at risk. At least 48 people have died in France from drowning as they attempted to seek respite from the crippling heat, while 2 young children were killed by heat in a car, authorities said. 2 elderly people died of heat stroke in Spain, which has experienced extreme temperatures since the weekend exceeding 40 degrees Celsius. Temperatures there were starting to ease on Wednesday. A rare weather pattern known as an Omega block was causing the record-breaking temperatures across Europe as high as 18 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit above normal, according to the Reuters Climate Monitor. The phenomenon resembles the shape of the Greek letter Omega, with a bulbous middle trapping in intensifying heat, hovering over regions for extended periods with cooling weather on its fringes. Weather agency Meteo France has said the conditions are comparable to a heat wave in August 2003 that lasted 16 days and caused an estimated 80,000 excess deaths across Europe. Europe is warming at more than twice the global average, the World Meteorological Organization has said, which makes prolonged heat episodes increasingly likely. In Paris, where the annual Fashion Week was underway, onlookers could be seen gasping and sweating during the Louis Vuitton show as male models showed off creations by pop singer Pharrell Williams. Labels including Dior and Rick Owens changed their schedules to hold shows in the morning, organizers said. The Eiffel Tower and the Louvre Museum shut early on Tuesday. In Switzerland, local authorities opened air-conditioned theaters for free daytime cinema screenings. Construction contractors across the continent altered working hours so employees could avoid the worst, while retailers struggled to meet demand for fans and portable air conditioners. A French agricultural cooperative said farmers were introducing night shifts for harvesting to protect workers from afternoon heat and fields from fire risk. In Britain, the grid operator asked generators to make more power available amid soaring temperatures, poised to break records later on Wednesday. Britain's train operators have advised only essential journeys on Wednesday and Thursday, as the heat has brought speed restrictions. In Italy, conditions were expected to worsen further, especially across central and northern regions, with the heat wave likely to peak between Sunday and Monday, meteorologists said. Temperatures could reach between 41 degrees Celsius between Tuscany and Emilia, while in coastal areas such as Liguria, the combination of heat and extreme humidity could drive perceived temperatures as high as 45 degrees Celsius. Next article, U.S.-Iran at odds on nuclear inspections, frozen assets in deal to end war. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Tuesday that Iran had agreed to nuclear inspections into infinity, while Tehran said it had made no such concession in negotiations, raising questions about the viability of their fragile peace deal. The two countries, which ended a first round of negotiations in Switzerland on Monday, also offered conflicting accounts about financial incentives for Iran, control of the Strait of Hormuz, and Israel's parallel war in Lebanon, all major aspects of their framework deal signed last week aiming to end the war. Nevertheless, Trump said negotiations with Iran were going smoothly. "We're getting along quite well," he said at a rally in Pennsylvania. The United States also relaxed travel curbs on Iran's World Cup soccer team, allowing it to travel from Tijuana, Mexico, to Seattle 2 days before its next match instead of one. In signs of withering domestic support for the war, Trump's poll numbers weakened while the Republican-controlled Senate defied the president and voted to halt the war in a largely symbolic move that highlighted fissures in his party. A Reuters Ipsos poll found 35% of Americans think the U.S. is now in a weaker position with Iran than before the war, while 23% believed it's in a stronger position. The Senate vote of 50-48 endorsed a resolution passed by the House of Representatives this month, reflecting growing concern even among some of Trump's Republicans about the unpopular conflict that began on February 28th. It was the first time both chambers of Congress had passed a resolution directing a president to remove U.S. armed forces from hostilities under the War Powers Act, though it was not immediately clear how the vote might affect the conflict. Though prospects for a lasting peace are far from certain, the initial agreement between Washington and Tehran has allowed traffic to flow again through the strait, which typically handles one-fifth of global energy supply. Trump said on Wednesday he had told the Justice Department to look into oil companies for not lowering pump prices in line with falling crude costs. "Gasoline prices better start going down a lot faster than what I'm seeing," he said on social media. Oil prices fell more than 1% on Wednesday, extending this week's losses in trading near their lowest since before the war began on February 28th. The United Nations Shipping Agency said it was working to evacuate 11,000 seafarers stranded when Iran closed the strategic waterway. The agreement calls for Iran to allow traffic to flow freely for 60 days, though it has said it might impose tolls or other fees on shipping subsequently. In a joint statement on Tuesday, Iran and Oman, which controls the other side of the strait, stressed their sovereign rights in the waterway, adding that they would work together to manage traffic along with associated costs. Oman said it had coordinated with the International Maritime Organization to provide a temporary corridor for vessels seeking to transit the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, visiting Gulf allies unsettled by the peace deal, said Iran would not be allowed to charge tolls in the strait as part of any final agreement. The deal calls for an immediate end to the war, including in Lebanon, lifting U.S. sanctions on Tehran, and unfreezing Iranian assets held abroad. It also outlines a $300 billion investment fund for the Islamic Republic's reconstruction. The framework itself sets no limits on Iran's nuclear program, an issue to be tackled in 60 days of negotiations. Trump claimed that Iran had agreed to allow international inspectors indefinite access to its damaged nuclear sites. Iran has fully and completely agreed to highest-level nuclear inspections long into the future. Infinity, Trump said on social media. Iran denied it had discussed its nuclear program at the talks and said it had not agreed to invite International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors back into the country. The two sides also disagreed on details of a provision that would give Iran access to funds that have been frozen in overseas accounts. Trump said any unfrozen assets would be used to buy food and medical supplies from the U.S., while Iran's ambassador to the United Nations in Geneva, Ali Bahraini, said Iran would decide how to spend that money. Washington has already agreed to waive sanctions on Iran for 60 days, allowing Tehran to sell oil and related products and receive payment for them. Israel's parallel war against Iran-backed Hezbollah in Lebanon also remains a sticking point. Bahraini said the deal requires Israel to withdraw its troops from Lebanon, while Israel has said it will maintain a security zone in southern Lebanon and act to neutralize threats against Israeli soldiers and citizens. Even as Israel and Lebanon renewed talks in Washington on Tuesday, Israeli gunfire killed two people in southern Lebanon, its civil defense and health ministry said, prompting Iran-backed Hezbollah to accuse Israel of violating a ceasefire that it has largely held since Sunday. Next article. UN's Guterres says climate risk must be core priority for finance ministers. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Wednesday that climate adaptation must be treated as a core priority for governments and properly valued by the financial system as climate risks intensify and a funding gap widens. As droughts, floods, and other extreme weather events affect communities worldwide, Guterres told policymakers and finance leaders at London Climate Action Week that adaptation has so far been undervalued and chronically underfunded. Finance ministers, central banks, planning ministries, and public investment authorities must treat climate risk as core economic policy in order to mobilize greater domestic resources, he said, urging governments to incorporate climate risk across everything from fiscal policy to regulation. Closing the gap will require a broad mix of tools, Guterres said, including levies on polluting industries, blended finance structures, and guarantees to encourage private investment. He called for windfall taxes on fossil fuel companies, with proceeds directed toward adaptation and climate-related losses and damage. Against the backdrop of reform of the world's development banks, he said their shareholders must give the lenders far greater firepower, including increased capital to scale up lending for resilience-building projects. The need for increased public and grant-based finance is most acute in developing countries, he said, which are the most exposed to climate impacts but have the least capacity to prepare. According to the United Nations Environment Program, these countries will need $310 to $365 billion a year by 2035, yet received only about $26 billion in 2023. Guterres said the financial system must also shift how it values resilience, particularly to attract more private capital. Countries that invest in reducing risk should be rewarded, not punished, he said, calling on insurers, regulators, and credit rating agencies to reflect adaptation efforts in lowering borrowing costs and better insurance terms. He added that stronger preparation before disasters strike is essential, including universal access to early warning systems and more affordable pre-arranged financing, such as insurance. You cannot allow climate disasters to become fiscal disasters, he said. Adaptation is an economic necessity, a development imperative, a security imperative, and a matter of climate justice. Next article, space startups seek insurance for orbital AI data centers. Space company have spoken with insurers about coverage for orbital AI data centers, a sign of early progress for an experimental industry backed by Elon Musk's SpaceX and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. The concept of data center satellites, designed to bypass Earth's power constraints, has drawn growing attention since Musk described them as the future of artificial intelligence development ahead of SpaceX's record-breaking public listing this month. Securing insurance is critical for companies trying to move orbital data centers from concept to reality. Without coverage for the costly hardware and risks involved, attracting the debt financing needed to scale such ventures would be difficult. Blue Origin and a host of space startups, including Orbital, StarCloud, Lone Star Data Holdings, and Cowboy Space, have also signaled their intention to launch space-based data centers. Reuters spoke to four brokers and underwriters and three space firms who said talks had taken place about orbital data center coverage, although they remain preliminary. Insurance broker Marsh said several companies have approached insurers to understand what future coverage for orbital data centers might entail without naming the firms. We're already starting to see companies that are focused on data centers and companies that are focused on digital infrastructure looking to the insurance community for support, said Patton Klein, U.S. aviation and space practice leader at Marsh. Lone Star said it recently held a briefing at Marsh's offices for insurance marketplace Lloyd's in London, attended by about 25 insurers. SpaceX and Blue Origin did not respond to requests for comment. Insurers already cover launch failures, satellite malfunctions, orbital debris, and space weather in a global space market that collects roughly $500 million in annual premiums, according to industry executives and insurance firm AXA XL. But while insurers have decades of experience covering satellites, they have little data on orbital AI infrastructure. The conversations in the market are focused on whether the risk can be modeled, whether what the premium should be, said Casey Rowe, who's the U.S. head of Upstage AI, which develops AI tools for insurance companies. Part of the challenge is valuing rapidly advancing AI chips, which could be vulnerable to harsh conditions in space, said Orbital CEO Ewan Poon. David Wade, space underwriter at Atrium, said venture capital-backed startups would have had to expand before there would be a major insurance market for orbital data centers. Until we get past that early round of financing and start seeing some of these companies expand by raising debt, I think the insurance needs are very limited at the moment. Next article. Seattle sticking with World Cup Pride match, hoping it can change minds. Seattle's LGBTQ community members say they hope that this Friday's World Cup Pride match between Egypt and Iran, two countries where homosexuality is criminalized, can be an opportunity to change minds. Seattle revels in its reputation as a welcoming place, and Pride flags are visible all over the city all year round. Its June Pride weekend is one of the biggest in the United States. So ahead of December's World Cup draw, it was only natural that local organizers designated the June 26th match to be held in the city as a Pride match. Then the draw happened, and the two teams scheduled to play the game were Egypt and Iran. Egypt's Football Association urged global soccer governing body FIFA to prevent any Pride-related activities, arguing such events clash with the Muslim-majority country's cultural and religious values. The governing body in Iran, where same-sex relations can carry the death penalty, filed an objection with FIFA. But in Seattle, there is no question that the Pride match will go ahead as planned. The World Cup is going to come and go in 3 weeks, Hedda McClendon from Seattle's local World Cup organization committee told Reuters. The Pride celebration has happened on this weekend for 50-plus years. It is going to happen this weekend. It is going to happen long after the World Cup. Some in the city's LGBTQ community had mixed feelings given the participants, said John Carnes, age 49, manager of the local LGBTQ club Kremwerk. Carnes, however, said his own view was that it provided a platform to promote acceptance that only the world's biggest sporting event could offer. My reaction is, let's have them, he told Reuters. International sports is one of the biggest brokers historically of social change and individual rights and freedom worldwide, including in the U.S. He cited black U.S. sprinter Jesse Owens' 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Nazi Germany and Tommy Smith and John Carlos' raised fist protest in 1968 as moments where only international sports could reach that big of an audience. They're not going to turn off the World Cup on state television in Iran or Egypt to block out a pride flag in the audience, Carnes said. The Pride match is a host city initiative and separate of FIFA, a spokesperson for soccer's governing body told Reuters. Egypt and Iran's involvement in the Pride match is not the first time the World Cup has grappled with stark differences in attitudes between hosts and visitors. In 2022, World Cup host Qatar, the Emir said visitors should respect our culture when asked about gay people attending the tournament. FIFA threatened yellow cards for captains wearing the One Love armband, citing its rules against political slogans. Teams including England and the Netherlands that had been planning to wear the armbands to protest Qatar's laws against same-sex relationships abandoned the plan. For Ryan Webster, a 40-year-old lifestyle manager who was at Kremwerk the weekend before Pride, Seattle's Pride match was an opportunity to show solidarity with people in countries where their sexuality was outlawed. I'm choosing to believe that this is our moment to allow the members of the LGBTQ community that come from those countries to have the opportunity to celebrate themselves in totality that they might not have otherwise, he said outside the club, which will host a watch party for Friday's game. Inside, Venus Feng's lip-synced to Cher's Believe before introducing fellow drag performers to the stage, clapped and cheered by a raucous crowd. Fangs, who wanted only to provide their stage name, said Pride coinciding with the World Cup would bring increased visibility, anticipating perhaps some new audience members. I think it's always great for us to be able to share space and share places with people who don't have the same experience as us, they told Reuters. Sometimes you just have to be the bigger person and show grace where you can and know that everyone is a human learning from different experiences. But also, it can get hard because you're on the shorter end of the stick, always trying to have to explain yourself around people who don't grow up with the same worldview. Next article, Keiko Fujimori's expected victory returns divisive dynasty to Peru. Keiko Fujimori's victory in her fourth bid for Peru's presidency returns a polarizing political dynasty to power, reviving deep divisions that have long split the South American country. Conservative Fujimori, age 51, narrowly defeated leftist Congressman Roberto Sanchez in one of the closest elections in Peru's modern history, winning a razor-thin June runoff that took weeks to determine. The contest unfolded amid queried ballots and a prolonged vote count, though international observers said both rounds proceeded normally. With 98.86% of the vote counted, Fujimori garnered an unbeatable lead late on Tuesday. Sanchez has claimed fraud and said he will refuse to recognize Fujimori's victory. Peru's ONPE Electoral Authority will officially announce the winner in mid-July. She is set to assume office on July 28th for a 5-year term as Peru's copper-exporting economy grapples with rising crime, corruption, and political instability. No Peruvian president has completed a full term in the past decade. Fujimori will become Peru's first elected female president. Her win follows 3 previous failed bids in 2011, 2016 and 2021, each decided by narrow margins and shaped in part by a persistent anti-Fujimori vote that has defined the country's elections for years. Analysts say her resilience underscores the enduring strength of Fujimorismo, the movement built around her late father, former President Alberto Fujimori. A divisive figure who governed from 1990 to 2000, he was credited for bringing stability to the country, but condemned by critics as an authoritarian. He spent 16 years in prison for human rights abuses committed when he was in power, and died in 2024 after his release. Keiko Fujimori entered public life early, serving as a de facto first lady at 19 after her parents separated. She later built her own political base, winning a congressional seat in 2006 with the highest vote total ever recorded for a Peruvian lawmaker. After once distancing herself from her father's legacy, she has increasingly embraced it, casting herself in this campaign as a strong hand capable of restoring order as Peru confronts surging crime and extortion rates. Among her proposal was reviving baseless judges, a controversial system used in the 1990s to prosecute terrorism and drug cases that was later condemned by rights groups for undermining due process. She has also emphasized economic stability, respect for private property, and closer ties with Washington, echoing other conservative governments in the region. Her political career has been shadowed by legal troubles. Fujimori spent nearly a year and a half in pretrial detention between 2018 and 2020 over illegal campaign financing allegations, which were dropped last year. Her running mate, Luis Galarreta, has framed that period as transformative, describing a new Keiko, who is more reflective and pragmatic. "She came out of prison without bitterness," Galarreta said in an interview with Reuters, adding that she now places greater emphasis on building a structured political organization. Still, Fujimori remains a divisive figure. Opponents argue her right-wing Popular Force Party, long a dominant force in Congress that is expected to hold the largest minority bloc with 41 lower house and 22 Senate seats in the 2026 to 2031 legislature, has contributed to Peru's broader cycle of instability. Protests against her candidacy drew hundreds of leftist supporters and civil society groups in Lima ahead of the runoff. Only 11% of the electorate voted for her in the election's first round. Fujimori will also face a fragmented party system that has been unable to form lasting governing coalitions. Corruption scandals have touched almost every Peruvian leader over the past three decades. The country has cycled through 8 presidents and 21 prime ministers over the last 10 years, and for most practical purposes, has lacked a national government. Fujimori takes over from José Balcázar, who assumed office earlier this year after Congress removed his predecessor over a scandal involving undisclosed meetings with a Chinese businessman. Peru's legislature has returned to a bicameral system with no party holding a majority in either chamber, a dynamic that has complicated governance and contributed to recurring impeachments. Right-wing allies could give Fujimori a narrow edge, analysts say. Her Popular Force Party will have 22 of the 60 Senate seats, enough to block impeachment. Eileen Gavin of Verisk Maplecroft said that while opposition to Fujimori softened somewhat during the campaign, it remains a powerful force. It is not clear that her rivals on the far right and center right in Congress will be willing to ally themselves with the Popular Force in any formal way, Gavin said, warning that divisions could complicate governance. Hopes that Peru will finally exit its vicious cycle of revolving door presidents may be sadly misplaced, added Gavin. Next article, China beats U.S. with world's fastest supercomputer, but race not geared for AI work. Out of San Francisco, China has overtaken the U.S. to win the top spot on a list of the world's fastest supercomputers, but the results may say more about Beijing's desire to show self-sufficiency in computing systems than its standing in the global AI race, experts said. The Lianshan system at the National Supercomputing Center in Shenzhen, China, uses domestically designed chips and won the top spot on the Top 500, a biannual global ranking of supercomputers, with the country's first listing in 3 years. The ranking comes as the U.S. and China are increasingly competing in advanced computing, with U.S. President Donald Trump on Monday signing an executive order that aims to put the U.S. ahead of China in the emerging field of quantum computing. In the June 2026 edition of Top 500, Lineshine beat out the previous title holder, El Capitan, a supercomputer housed at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory that the U.S. government uses to develop and maintain its nuclear weapons stockpile. But technology and policy experts interviewed by Reuters said the results do not mean that China has the world's fastest supercomputer for AI work because of changes in the computing industry in recent years and the methods used to compile the list. Lineshine ranked fourth on a benchmark test designed to simulate computing work that is more similar to AI. For decades, supercomputers strung together many separate machines to work on complex scientific problems such as simulating how atoms interact with one another, and were mostly the domain of national labs and universities. To be ranked on the top 500 list, supercomputer operators must run a set of benchmark tests that aims to mimic such work. But in more recent years, cloud computing companies such as Microsoft, Amazon, and Alphabet's Google built out massive supercomputers on their own, but geared them for AI work instead. Most of these companies do not opt to compete for a spot on the top 500 list. A study last year by AI policy researchers Konstantin Pils, James Sanders, Robbie Raman, and Lennart Heim found that SpaceX-owned AI's Colossus system was already likely more powerful than the U.S. government's El Capitan. If the hyperscalers submitted their systems, this world's fastest would not crack the top five, said Jimmy Goodrich, a senior fellow at the University of California's Institute for Global Conflict and Cooperation. The Chinese victory on the list more likely shows that China wanted recognition for its chip design efforts, which is a change from recent years, experts said. China first took the top spot on the top 500 in 2010 and traded titles back and forth with the U.S. and Japan until 2023, when China stopped submitting its system after years of chip and computing-related export controls from Trump's first administration and later under President Joe Biden. I'm not surprised it's the number one system. What I'm surprised by is that they submitted it and want recognition for it, said Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research, a firm that focuses on supercomputers. The Lineshine system does not contain any advanced AI chips, according to details presented with the results, likely because the tools to make those chips are still subject to U.S. export controls. China is hoping to convince the world export controls are useless by hoping we ignore the details, Goodrich said. The National Supercomputing Center did not respond immediately to a request for comment. That's all the time that we have for today. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Reuters on the Talking Information Center.